This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
13th Avenue in downtown Portland. Thursday, August 1st, doors open at 6:30 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife. Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
Good morning, and welcome to the August edition of Black Book Talk. You've been listening to a selection called They'll Know We Are Christians, also known as We Are One in the Spirit. That was performed by the AME Zion National Mass Choir. My name is Patricia Welch, and I am one of the co-hosts of Black Book Talk.
And I'm Emma Jackson Ford. Welcome.
And we are pleased today to welcome Dr. Earl Bracey to Black Book Talk. He is the author of The Making of a Psychologist. Dr. Bracey, welcome to Black Book Talk.
Good morning, Patricia and Emma. It's actually afternoon in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Ah, okay.
Glad to be with you today.
We are delighted to have you here. Actually, The Making of a Psychologist is your second book, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, am I correct in thinking that there are not a whole lot of practicing African-American clinical psychologists in this country?
The last count, 2% of the population, it's like it's only 2% are African-American psychologists. So I think in the city of Milwaukee, we probably have 4 at this time.
Okay, so certainly we want to know how you made this professional choice, but just the story of your life and your childhood and how this informed many of your decisions in life is just so key. So could you sort of introduce yourself to our audience by telling us a little bit about your upbringing and the effect that had on you, your early life?
Yes, I was born in a small town that's about 20 miles outside of Mobile, Alabama. And at that time, it was the segregated South, the Jim Crow South. We had to leave our hometown via bus. We were bused, but we were bused to the next town over to an all-black school. We had to pass the white school, high school, where all of the white students could attend, but we could only look at it, could not attend that school. It was during the era of when Martin Luther King and Ralph Abernathy and some of the other civil rights leaders were very active. The climate in the South was very tense. Although we were never really threatened, it was just kind of that underlying tension that you knew was there all the time. Came from a family of 12 children. children, 11 brothers and sisters. My father was a minister slash pastor. My mother played the piano and organ in the church. And we, as a family, we got a lot of love and support. And I guess back in that those days, we kind of needed that because we were, the surroundings were very hostile. And I think that everybody kind of pitched in, teachers, people in the community, they all, I guess, saw us as their children. And the teachers that we had, I think, were very good teachers. They attended places like Morehouse College, Southern University, Fisk University, Alabama A&M, Alabama State, on and on. So we got a lot of, I think, a lot of things that a lot of the kids don't get today in regards to love, discipline, direction, guidance, and all those things, in spite of the segregationist stance. And at that time, George C. Wallace was the governor of Alabama, and he was a staunch segregationist. And as you know, he stood in the doorway of the University of Alabama, flanked by two state troopers so that no black students could be enrolled at that time.
That is very much the image that many of us across the country had of Wallace. And though apparently he had an epiphany later on in life, it was still very difficult to erase those images.
Yes, very true. And you say that he had an epiphany. He also, the person who pushed his wheelchair was a black male. He was, George C. Wallace, as you know, was shot by a white man from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, actually. And, you know, he kind of, it went 360 degrees because he couldn't stand in front of the doorway. But it was very odd that he had to be pushed in a wheelchair by a black male, someone that he had previously detested and saw as, I guess, a sense of disdain or disdainful.
Yes.
Could you say a little bit more about your teachers? What, because I want to think about what teachers can do to help the youth with overcoming racism or being able to, to a certain degree, ignore it.
You know, it's very odd. I'm not, they had something special. In spite of everything that they went through, because they were, most of them were a generation before me and the other students, they were able to withstand the insults, the harshness, just the, I guess, the state of the situation during that time. They had a lot of, I think, composure, a lot of pride, a lot of dignity and self-respect. And this is something that they kind of transferred onto their students. And in spite of what we saw and what we heard, we were able to kind of take the things that our parents and what our teachers had given us and, I guess, in a sense, make lemonade out of lemons, if you will. And I think this is what's needed for the kids today even more. You know, they've got a lot more than we had in regards to everything, but oftentimes they don't take advantage of these things. I think it has to be kind of bombarded repetitiously into their brains to let them know that they can make it. I think also that a lot of the kids, they don't see it as any, that there's anything wrong. You know, we saw the segregation and we saw the discrimination. But with a lot of the kids today, it can be right there around them, but they're not able to pick it up or detect it. And if it does happen, they really don't know how to deal with it.
You know, I want to mention, I just heard an interview about a new book that's out. It's about Dunbar High School, which was the first African-American high school in the country. It was in Washington, D.C. And it kind of reinforces what you were saying about your teachers, that a lot of the people who taught at that school were people who had fantastic educational degrees but couldn't really use them in the way that we can now. And so these children had, I mean, just exceptional teachers. But also, I think that and I'm not touting segregation because the author was very, very concerned about that, but that children who are seen not as the other and not as exceptional because they do well, but just as children and who are encouraged to do well and record, you know, rewarded and whatnot, they can grow up in a very, very segregated environment. And in some ways, I think even be protected by it, because I think that's what happened in our communities, that our children were protected by people, as you said, teachers who love them. And I want to emphasize this, and I'm sitting here, Emma is a teacher, so she's not going to say this, but I will say that I am sitting here next to an exceptional teacher. And again, I see the difference that people who love teaching and can share that love and that discipline, right, you know, that you mentioned, it does make all the difference in the world. But I want to fast forward a little bit, if you don't mind. Sure. Okay, we know you're raised in the South, but then you said you survived Jim Crowism in the South, but you encountered an even deeper form of racial hatred and bigotry among moving north. Tell us a little bit about that, and then we do want to get into, you know, the book and right, and that. But that was sort of a fascinating quote for me.
Yeah, that was very interesting. I moved from Alabama to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Actually, it was a suburb of Milwaukee. My uncle and aunt lived in the. He had no children, so he asked my mother and father if they could, if one of the boys could come and live with him. So, for some reason, I volunteered. I think it was kind of fate. After I think about it over and over again, and that was the first time. But then I went into the military, and I came back to Milwaukee, and that was the year of the riots across the country. I saw a lot of things in Milwaukee that I hadn't seen in the South, such as Ku Klux Klansmen dressed in their garb, just the containment by the Milwaukee Police Department against black males in particular. It was a kind of a rude eye-opener. It was an extension of Jim Crow as you saw it in the South. There were many opportunities, but at the same time, there was the redlining, where even if you had a professional degree as a black person, you couldn't buy homes in certain areas. There were some neighborhoods that were just off-limits to black people in general, and you kind of knew where those neighborhoods were. So as a young man coming to Milwaukee, I participated in the marches with Father James Grappi that I think most people across the country know. And I didn't realize it at the time, but my life was in danger quite a bit. I was never in trouble or anything, but I had a conviction, and I guess it was because of what I had seen in the South. I was going to stand up for the things that I thought were wrong at that time. And even today, I think that Milwaukee, even though it's changed, there's also been a great deal of regression. The old neighborhoods that were, I guess, morally and the neighborhoods that had a lot of family values, they were intact, two-parent black families. It seems like we worked hard for that, but you don't see that now. The neighborhoods they've gone backwards. There's a lot of, I guess you could say, degradation. Lots of, single-parent families are across the country, but it doesn't mean that things are bad. But in this instance, we see the single-parent families, and things are really bad, because no one in the neighborhood owns a home, so the neighborhoods are deteriorated. And this wasn't, it was true in the 60s, but it wasn't as true as it is today. You know, you would think that people would move forward, but we're starting to regress, and this is something that's going to be very problematic as we progress through time.
Okay, tell me why you chose psychology as your weapon of choice against racism, and what the effect of this racism, you know, how does it play out in terms of behaviors in our community and the psyche of black folks, especially young black folks today?
Right. I'm not sure if I had this kind of a thing for human behavior, if I've always been interested in, you know, trying to figure out why people do the things that they do. But general psychology was a course that I really liked in college, and I just felt like I would come back to it. I was in the medical field first, and then I came back to psychology. But I feel that as a black male and as a psychologist, I can do something to help many, many families, many individuals, particularly adolescents, and especially adolescent males, and oftentimes adult males, because a lot of times men don't say what's on their mind, or they feel like they're, you know, they don't have a voice and that nobody is listening. And I know I get pleasure out of kind of guiding people and letting them know that they can do better, you know, they can improve their lot in life. And, you know, if they just have that determination and that drive and that perseverance to, you know, get things done, that it can happen. And, you know, there's so many people that are, just say, off base, off target. And without the guidance and without the direction, you know, they're just going to be spinning their wheels and lost. And I've had adult males, and I've had a lot of adolescent males come back to me like 5-10 years later. And one kid in particular, he said he saw me at a supermarket. And I think it was about 8-10 years later. And he said, you know, Dr. Bracy, I didn't recognize him, but he recognized me. He said, you thought that when you were talking to me that I wasn't listening. But I was listening. And he went on to tell me that he had gone to school and he had a good job. And this happens all the time. And it's kind of like, you know, just helping one person at a time, because if you help one person, you don't know how many people that one person is going to help. So it's a kind of like a ripple effect.
Dr. Bracy, in your book, you talk about the war on drugs.
Right.
And how it's waged primarily on people of color. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's, we always get the impression that drug abuse and drug distribution is always an inner-city problem. But it starts at the top. And, you know, in my practice, I see many, many clients. And with the black kids, you see maybe the drug usage, and it's mainly marijuana. And what we don't hear is that in the populations in the suburbs with the white kids, it may be 3, 4, 5, 6 different drugs that are being used. But when we hear it from the media, it's kind of like it's just in one area, the central cities of the country. And I think that drugs are something that are also destroying the neighborhoods. I would say somewhere around the mid-80s, we had the crack epidemic. And this is when we saw things kind of take off in a really just kind of a disastrous direction. The depreciation of the neighborhoods, the destruction of the families as we saw them, you know, before. And I guess I always get somewhat discouraged and disheartened, you know, when I know that the drugs are coming in from other places. And the even with the sentences that we see with drugs, you know, the black male tends to get the harshest sentence. And if we look at the prison population today, we'll find a lot of males, adolescent and adult males in prison. And a lot of those men are in prison because of drugs. And even with the sentencing of marijuana, you know, sometimes in the suburban areas, the kids will get kind of like a slap on the hand, and the black kids will be incarcerated for maybe just a small amount of marijuana or something like that. So I think that, you know, drugs play a big part, and there's like a ripple effect, this kind of a domino effect. And when we look at the neighborhoods, we can't control the drug usage. You know, we're not going to be able to strengthen these neighborhoods. And this is what we need to do, is to strengthen the neighborhoods. And it's going to have to really start from the children that are at an early age, so that they're not seeing things that are negative. So this is where we need the role models, the positive role models. And especially, the men are not around, you know, we're not going to be making a lot of progress here. You know, the women can do it, but we, you know, I go into a lot of different venues and I see many, many women, but oftentimes the men are missing. We need men in the lives of these children.
Okay, we want to break for just a moment and say this is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM on your dial. Okay.
Early childhood that you were talking about, I teach third grade, and there's this thing around called the classroom to prison pipeline.
Right, yep.
So I'm always working on making sure I talk about the future to help them to realize that they have a great future, but you need to do this, this, and this. Can you think of some things that I should be saying to students to make sure that they stay out of the pipeline?
Yes, if they can know the difference between, number one, delayed and immediate gratification. Education is important. You know, they don't have to be like their next-door neighbor or the kid down the block. Those role models that are negative. And just kind of remind them that, you know, the money is going to come. If that's what they're interested in, but they have to prepare themselves educationally. You know, getting something in a quick way, you know, it's not going to help them because sometimes they're going to end up in prison or they're going to end up in the cemetery. So I try to pull out their strengths, to tease out their talents, because everybody that I work with, they've got something that they're good at.
Yes.
You know, and they don't have to take that path where they're selling drugs because they saw somebody else do it. Or they feel like I have to hurt someone because I'm so angry. So, you know, so just helping them to tease out that anger so that they can, when they do become adults, you know, they don't, because what I find sometimes is that if they don't deal with the situation or the problems in early childhood or adolescence, it's going to come out in their early adult years or later. And the way it comes out is going to be very sometimes dramatic, traumatic. And, you know, sometimes when we see these homicides, we wonder, well, you know, he was such a nice guy. I wonder what happened. You know, well, you know, these things that he needed to get out, he didn't really get them out when he should have gotten them out.
Yes. Do you deal primarily with males in your practice?
It varies. I would say I do work with a lot of families as well, but I find myself being referred many, many adolescent males, and especially black males.
Yes.
I'm curious, why did you choose to write this book?
You know, this was a compilation of about 18 years. And I thought that it was a story that needed to be heard. There were times in my life when I witnessed certain things, I experienced things, people said or did things to me, and I was kind of like a passive bystander. I didn't, like, say a lot, even during the... If you read the book and you look at the days when I worked in surgery in the medical field, I thought I could, like, help people this way rather than kind of retaliate one-on-one. Every time somebody did something or said something to me, that I could put it in writing and it could help, like, other people, because as I talk to people, you know, they'll say something to me like, well, I went through the same thing that you went through, so I understand. I understand exactly what you're saying. So it's mainly a teaching tool for people to help them to whatever struggle they're going through, to let them know that they can get through it. And they actually don't have to be vindictive. They can be angry, but they don't have to be vindictive about it.
Okay, well, Dr. Bracey, first of all, thank you so much for writing the book, The Making of a Psychologist, and thank you for sharing your insights with us today. So when your next book comes out, we hope that you'll come back to us again and let us know. But thank you for being on Black Book Talk this morning.
Sure, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Okay. All right. Do we have any announcements of things that are going on this month that our listeners should hear about? I think, what is it, the MLK Walk is coming up, Walk Run. Is coming up, I believe, this weekend. Lots of free concerts in the parks that we hope you'll hear about. And as a librarian, I would be remiss if I did not say that there are still a number of programs. Go into your local library, check the at your library listings. There are media camps taking place where youngsters can come in and actually videotape their elders. And there's going to be a film festival in September to show these films. There are hula hoop camps. There are all kinds of things. And there's, you know, story times abound. So we hope that people will take advantage of that. Before closing, or as I close, we wanted to do a tribute to somebody. There's so much talent in our community, and we're not always aware of it, or sometimes, unfortunately, we don't celebrate it. But I just want to take this moment to celebrate the life of the late Furman Haynes. If you read the Scanner and probably in some other newspapers, you noted that Mr. Haynes died recently. But I just wanted to read a little bit about it. It's not Valentine's Day, but I know him and Mrs. Haynes, and I know that theirs was very much a love story. So we wanted to play something to honor him and also to say to her that, you know, we are with you. But Mr. Haynes, known as Smiley Haynes, and truly, if you knew Mr. Haynes, you saw a beautiful smile. He was a legendary harmony singer, lived in Portland, Oregon for many years. He traveled the world, sang with everybody from Ella Fitzgerald to Count Basie to Bill Lanford and Johnny Smith's Ink Spots. And a lot of people didn't know that. Those young people, you might not know about the Ink Spots, but I think all of us who are sitting here know. Fantastic group. So, you know, we had that level of talent here. But some of you might have also known Mr. Haynes because he worked at Kaiser Health Center and was just as warm and kind and giving at helping patients and others as he was gracious and charming when he was entertaining. But a little history, there is a recording called, it's a CD called The Lost Recordings of the Masters. And the Masters was a group that Mr. Haynes formed with, it was Furman Smiley Haynes, Clyde Popcorn Davis, and Tony Mr. Lee. And on this recording, they have a lot of outtakes from recording sessions of trying to put together that first album. And one of them is Don't Cry, and that's a lead vocal by Mr. Haynes. And his wife particularly liked that, so we wanted to play a little bit of that and just say to all of the wonderful, talented people in Portland, you are not forgotten. Have a wonderful August, and we'll be back in September.
Don't cry, darling, don't ever cry, darling, and I'll come back to you. Darling, you're my darling, and no one else is gonna do. Don't worry your head, I say, just dry your eyes. Every soul's on doesn't mean goodbye. So please don't cry, darling, don't cry, darling, and I. Come back to you.
It- It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Thursday, August 1st. Oregon State University has joined Portland State and the University of Oregon in opting to be governed by an independent governing board, members of which would be nominated by John Kitzhaber himself. Historically, all seven public institutions in the state were overseen by the Board of Higher Education. The remaining schools can decide later whether or not to have their own boards. Independence from state boards may increase fundraising options and donor acquisition because a distant, beleaguered board will not hamstring the universities. A Federal Bureau of Investigation program, Operation Cross Country, netted four pimps and 13 prostitutes in East County. Two of the prostitutes were minors. The sting lasted about a day. The national effort targeted streetwalkers, online purveyors, and truck stops in 76 American cities. The FBI worked in concert with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children as part of the FBI's Innocence Lost Initiative. 105 minors were rescued nationwide. Julie Miller is now a millionaire 18 times over after suing credit reporting company Equifax. After being denied a line of credit in 2009, and after a year of unsuccessful attempts to clear her name, she discovered that Equifax had bad information linked to her name, including an incorrect birth date and an incorrect Social Security number. 20% of consumers have flawed credit reports. A United Nations official stated that forcing Cyprus to unify the divergent ethnic split between the Turkish Cypriot and the Greek Cypriot to bolster economic situation would be a disaster. Peace negotiations will begin in October after an 18-month break. The UN voted to keep peacekeeping forces on the island until January 2014. Weather in Portland has taken a turn for the rainy. Despite the light rain in the city, the threat of fire in the rest of the state has increased because an upper-level low-pressure system has been moving through the northwest, creating little rain and an increase in lightning strikes.